and Norm Shealy. NormShealy.com. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Peter Sturrock, and we're going to talk about his work in physics at Stanford and other places. And we're going to talk about something unusual for my show, and that's UFOs and anomalies. How are you, Dr. Sturrock?
I am very well. Thank you, Eva.
Thank you for coming on my show. Before we get started, if you would, tell us a little bit about you, what you do, and how you came to do it, and where people can find you.
Well, I grew up in England many years ago. I came to Stanford in 1955. I've been there ever since, a professor in applied physics. I've worked mainly in physics, electrical engineering, and astrophysics. But in addition, I've had an interest in what I call non-politically correct topics, one of which you've mentioned, UFOs, but others are parapsychology and other topics that we can talk about. So I've had a mixture of topics that are usually taught in universities and topics that you'll never hear taught in universities.
Did you work with Bill Tiller?
No, but I knew Bill very well. He was at Stanford and I was. I didn't work with him, but we were good friends, and we still are, I hope.
Oh, he's a great guy. I love him. He's one of my favorite guests to have on, so that's one reason I wanted to have you, because I figured you would have similar interests. What about Bernard Haise? Did you ever do anything with him?
Yes, indeed. Yes, Bernie played a very important role in the Society for Scientific Exploration, which I helped found, and Bernie was for many years the editor of our journal.
Oh, well, how about that? I didn't realize that y'all had that connection.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I like him, too. He's been on my show a couple of times. So where can people find you?
Well, I do have a website called exoscience.org, but if you go to Google or Wikipedia, you'll find a story about me in each place. And you can also learn more about me from my memoirs, which came out a year ago. It's called A Tale of Two Sciences, Memoirs of a Dissident Scientist, and that's me.
I love it. It's great. Okay, so the first question is, you have a couple of books out, The Enigma, The UFO Enigma, which I did not get to read, and I found out about today. So I've asked you this morning if you would draw me up a couple of some questions about your non-politically correct science. What is that?
Well, they are topics that scientists shy away from. If you ask a scientist about physics or astronomy, they'll love to talk to you and they'll be happy to do it. Ask them about parapsychology and they kind of shrink, make a joke of it, and walk away as rapidly as they can. There are topics that you don't meet in the usual scientific venue, and they appear to be impossible on the basis of present-day physics. And scientists like to answer questions that they can answer, that they have the answer to. And so we don't have an answer to things like UFOs, and we don't get information about them through the usual routines of scientific journals and so on. I can't go to meeting the American Astronomical Society and talk about UFOs. So most scientists know nothing about them, and they know that what they do hear sounds crazy. It doesn't sound compatible with the science they know, and they therefore assume that it must be nonsense.
Yeah, I have to admit I've been guilty. Not totally of that, but I have to pick and choose who I listen to, you know, else I tend to let it go. But your information, I have to say, is very credible. Can't dispute it. I mean, I believe that it's somewhere out in the universe there exists other forms of life, but your information, you can't dispute about what kind of life that is. So tell us I'd like to know how you deal with this problem of people thinking you're a heretic when the science is actually so good to support it?
Well, luckily, I have a good support group. About in 1980, I tried to publish an article on UFOs, a very carefully written article, very sober, and I submitted it to five different journals, and none of them would take it. They all gave different reasons for rejecting it. And I, at that time, met Dr. Robert Jahn, who was then Dean of Engineering at Princeton, who was then working on parapsychology, and he had the same experience, that he could write articles, but journals would not publish them. So we realized that we had to have a journal where we could publish our research. And to do that, we formed a society, the Society for Scientific Exploration. And you can learn more about that by typing in scientificexploration.org, and that'll tell you all about it.
Okay.
But then, so I've had this support group, this society, as colleagues for over for 25 years or more.
So, tell me, what is the Condon Report?
Okay. Let's see. The Air Force began having publicly acknowledged studies, Project Grudge, something else, and then Blue Book. And it was a headache for them. The press wanted to know, what have you learned, and if there's nothing to it, why are you continuing Blue Book? So in order to get out of that, they asked a university, any university, to carry out a study of the UFO area, and the University of Colorado took it on under the direction of Edward Condon. And that is a very mixed bag. If you look at the detailed work of the scientists in that team, it's very good work, and they indicate there's something serious to look at. If you look at what Condon wrote, there's no relation to the work of his own team, and he says there's nothing to it. The Air Force should get out of this business. It should close down Blue Book. So the Air Force promptly closed down Blue Book, and that was it. And now it was so influential. All the newspapers, all the scientific journals carried a story about the Condon Report, and the Condon decided there's nothing to it, and that it was all nonsense. And that has really frozen the subject for many, many years.
You reviewed that Condon Report, didn't you?
I did. That was the article that I wrote that I couldn't get published. It was an analysis of the Condon Report. I went through it kind of page by page and chapter by chapter, and pointing out what was good about it, which was the work of the staff, and what was not good about it, which was the work of Condon himself. And I said, if you ignore what Condon wrote and simply read what his staff did and what his staff wrote, you'll get a good introduction to the subject. If you read only what Condon wrote, you'll get a poor introduction.
So what, for my listeners who haven't had an opportunity to read that, what is it, just give me a bottom line of what it's telling us.
What, the Condon Report?
Yes, the good science in there.
Well, if you look in the Condon Report, you'll find some very interesting cases that the staff themselves thought might be due to real kind of spacecraft. For instance, a case that occurred at Lakenheath Air Force Base in England in the 1950s. An object was picked up by two different radar systems in two different air bases, and they scrambled some jet fighters, and the jet fighters sent some objects. They couldn't close in on them, and they returned to the base low on fuel. And so there are a couple of cases like that. Another one called the RB-47 case that took about 2 hours or 2.5 hours total of one aircraft with lots of radar gear on it, and two or three ground radar stations tracking an object.
And what do you have any idea, or does do anybody that you know have any idea why the extraterrestrials or UFOs come here? Or where they come from, or how they get here?
We have no idea. We're still in the stage of really trying to get the basic information. You know, what is going on? Are these really spacecraft? Some people think that hallucinations of some kind, but we're really in a very early stage, and it's very hard to do research when you can't publish what you're doing.
I guess it would be hard to repeat it, too, identically the same way every time.
That's right.
And get accepted.
So
my listeners are familiar with a lot of this work. Like, they're familiar with Dean Radin's work, and they're familiar with Bob John's work at Princeton, because we've interviewed Bernard Heisch. I just didn't connect your name, really, when I interviewed, because I didn't know. But what I'd like to ask you next is, Rockefeller contacted you, didn't he?
Yes, he did, through Henry Diamond, who was Mr. Lawrence Rockefeller's lawyer in Washington, D.C. And about 15 years ago, I had a call from Mr. Diamond. He let me know that Mr. Lawrence Rockefeller was interested in the UFO issue, and would I like to meet with him, which I did. And so we had a very interesting meeting, a good discussion of what one could do to study the field. And I suggested setting up a panel review of getting about 8 or 9 experienced investigators and about 8 or 9 scientists who knew nothing about the subject with a variety of skills and knowledge, and then see what kind of report the scientific panel would give to the presentations.
And what did his... Did he have any specific questions? I'm just curious what his questions
would be. No, it's wide open. I said that in order to get the interest, in order to make progress, one needed to get wider scientific interest and wider body of scientists. And I thought the best way to do that was to see if there had any physical evidence related to this field. And so what I proposed was getting a group of investigators to present the different kinds of physical evidence they'd come across. For instance, photographic, radar, ground traces, vegetation traces, and so on. And so that's what we did.
Was he... Do you have any idea why he wanted to know this?
I think he just was a man of very wide interest and interested in philosophy of all kinds, and just for his personal interest.
Okay. I just, you know, he's such a powerful man. I just wondered, did he have really no more than he was telling us and trying to figure out what to do about it?
No, I think it was completely on the up and up. He simply had this personal interest, and he wanted to get some enlightenment from someone.
So when did that occur?
I should know that off the bat. It was, I think, about 15 years ago, I would say.
And what happened as a result of it? Anything?
Well, as a result of that, we first of all published a report, mainly the conclusions or the views of the panel, and it was 1997 was the year of the meeting, and when Stanford put out a press release on that report, there was tremendous interest there, and you know, I was on TV for days and then radio and so on. That was like a big stone being dropped in the water. There's a big splash, and then the stone sinks, and you'd never know anything had happened. Everything quietened down, and there were no reports of it in the, no reviews of it in the scientific journals, which I'd hoped, and you did not find any discussion of it in, say, the New York Times or newspapers like that. But there was great public interest at the time.
It's hard to believe it, that nobody picked up on that like that. So has anything happened since that, Tom, to further that?
In the comparable to that study? Well, there have been some documentaries come out, some very good documentaries, and one called Out of the Blue, in which a lot of influential people, like ex-astronauts and came forward and described their experiences. There was a very extensive series of sightings in Belgium 10 or more years ago, and they have been reported officially by the Belgian Air Force. So that's happened. Now, the other important thing is that France had a UFO research study going on called JIPON, the study group for the study of unusual aerial phenomena with that effect. And that went on for 20 or more years, and they did very good work. Dr. Velasco was the last director of that I know, and he's written a book on the subject. He took part in the Rockefeller meeting in Pocantico.
Is there any case or any piece of information supporting UFO or the existence of them or activity that particularly stands out in your mind?
Well, if you ask, what case or cases I think would make most impact on someone who knew nothing about the subject, I'd say one of them would be the helicopter case that occurred in Mansfield, Ohio, about 20-odd years ago. There, four Army Reserve members were flying. They went to Columbus to get their annual physical checkups. Then they were flying back from Columbus back to Columbus from Cleveland. And one of the crew noticed a bright light on the horizon. And after a while, he drew the attention of the other crew members to that light. And it got brighter. And the Captain Coyne was in control, and he was convinced there's going to be a collision. They're all going to be dead within a few seconds. He put these object came. It filled the entire windscreen. It was a grayish metallic object with a white light in the rear and a very bright green light that shone into the cockpit of the craft helicopter, and Coyne put the controls in such a way that the helicopter should be making a rapid descent to get out of the way of the object. Well, the object was around for only a few seconds, maybe tens of seconds, then it shot off at great speed. Then Coyne found, to his amazement, that the helicopter was not lower, it was 2,000 feet higher than it was before it took off. So somehow, as a result of this encounter with whatever it was, the controls did not control what the helicopter was doing. The controls told the helicopter to go down lower. Instead, for some reason, it went up higher. So there have been cases like this where controls don't behave the way they normally do when you're having an encounter like that.
Wow. So what happened to that information? Why did they suppress it?
That was not suppressed. They submitted a report, and the report was publicly available, and I cover the main content of that report in my book, The UFO Enigma.
But why do they suppress information about UFOs?
Well, we don't know they do or what they do, and that's really speculation. And I'd rather just try to learn what I can about the evidence and the witnesses.
Well, do you have any idea or any knowledge about crop circles?
Well, I really don't. I think they are intriguing. I think the problem was very much muddied, situated by two men who claimed that they had produced all the crop circles by dragging pieces of wood around. But some of the images I've seen of those crop circles are remarkably complicated. And it would take great skill to produce them, and so I think they remain a great puzzle as to what is going on.
And I understand that you have probably no idea the answer to this question. That's factual. I'm just curious. Do you have any even idea of what it would take to make one of those? Is it some kind of energy form, and how do you suppose the energy would form those things? Would it come out of the ground? Would something be emitting it, like from a UFO? Or have you ever thought about it?
You're talking about crop circles, are you?
Yeah.
No, I have no idea. They're just remarkable. But one of the curious things is that if you take a piece of wood and use it to squash down the stand of corn, it breaks the stems and the corn dies. Now, the curious thing about these crop circles is that the stems are bent over, but they're not broken, and the corn is not dead. So something that's very, very curious is going on, and we don't understand it at all.
Has anybody ever, and I'm sure they have, measured to see if there's any kind of energy coming from them? I don't know the words because I'm limited in my language.
Yeah, that's the field that I've really not looked into either.
Okay.
I think some people probably have attempted that, but I don't know them. I don't know what their results were.
Okay, that's all right. Okay, another thing I'd like to know about is we talked this morning about the 1908 explosion in Siberia.
Yes.
That was the first time I'd ever heard anything about it. Can you tell us about that?
In Tunguska. Well, in 1908, there was a tremendous explosion in a very, very remote area called Tunguska in Siberia. And it flattened the trees for several square miles. It flattened about 100,000 trees were laid out almost in a radial pattern. And oddly enough, nobody was killed. Nobody was near enough to the explosion to actually get killed. Some reindeer were burned and killed, were died, but no human being was killed. But it was the equivalent of about 50 megatons of TNT, which is as big as the biggest nuclear device that's ever been exploded here. And there are very many puzzles to it. When scientists first heard about this, and it took a while for the information to get from that remote area to where the scientists were, they thought, well, it's got to be one of two things. That's either a meteorite or a comet. And if it's a meteorite, there will be a big chunk of stone or a big chunk of iron somewhere where that explosion occurred. If it's a comet, there should be some kind of debris, some information. The comet is not pure ice; it has other things mixed in with it. So we should be able to find some debris from either the meteorite or the comet. And they've been looking ever since, and there have been several expeditions out there, and they've never found what they expected, namely a big chunk of iron or a big chunk of stone. It's a big puzzle. One of the remarkable facts about that explosion is that in the very center of where the explosion occurred, trees were still standing. They were not flattened. Their branches had all been burned off or blasted off, but the tree trunks were still standing.
So it was kind of like a donut shape?
Well, it's like what was found at Hiroshima, that most of the town was demolished, but in the very center, directly under where the explosion occurred, buildings were still standing.
So what do you think that means?
Well, it means there was a very sudden release of energy. It wasn't, if it were, say, a meteorite or a comet coming by at high speed, it would leave a big track, a swathe of destruction. But if it were a sudden flash of something, then you might see this peculiar result of a radial devastation with things being untouched in the very middle.
So did it make a hole in the ground, or was it just topically?
Oh, there is no hole. There's a crater there from a lake. There's all kinds of terrain has, hills and valleys and lake and so on. But there's no obvious crater that you expect to see from a kind of explosion like that.
And what do you think it was?
Well, we don't know, but I think what we do know is that it wasn't a meteorite and it wasn't a comet. And this so it's either something natural we don't understand, we've never seen before, or something unnatural. And we really don't know without finding. We really need to find some traces of what went on. Some particles.
So how is the land today? Did it kill it off, or has it refurbished itself?
No, the curious thing is that the growth after 1908 grew more rapidly than before.
Interesting. Now, what could feed the growth to do that? Is there some kind of radioactive or some kind of energy that would support growth?
Well,
like that?
There seem to be two possibilities. One is there are some kind of trace elements, like various trace elements can speed up growth. I forget the names of them. Lanthanum, one of them. The other thing is that ionizing radiation can lead to genetic changes, mutations in the plants, and these mutations can give rise to more rapid growth. Which it is, we don't know.
Has anybody studied that and found out if that's happened or not?
Well, it is known that the growth did speed up, and it looks as if it's more compatible with mutations than with new impurities.
Oh, okay, interesting. So, do they know if the explosion was caused from something and coming from the sky, or if it came from something in the ground?
Well, there are a lot of eyewitness reports, and it's very, very curious because they're not consistent. There's one group of reports to the east of where the explosion occurred, describing a bright red object traveling at high speed towards where the explosion occurred. There's another group of observations from the south of where the explosion occurred saying, no, we saw an object going north. So whether there was one explosion carrying out a kind of zigzag course, or whether there are two objects that happen to bump into each other, we just don't know.
Interesting. Is there anything else you know about that you can tell us before we go on to the next topic that I haven't asked about?
No.
Anymore? Okay.
It covers the main points about it.
That's interesting.
Yes, it really is fascinating. There's one more thing I might mention, that in 1904, a U.S. ship for U.S. supply, oddly enough, was off the coast of Korea. And the crew of that ship saw what they call three strange meteors, which were big red objects that came down, that were traveling horizontally below the clouds. And then when they were near the ship, they took off and traveled in echelon formation and took off and traveled rapidly away from the craft, from the ship. So they were describing an object or objects similar to what were described in 1908 by the people near Tunguska.
Interesting. Okay, my next question is sounds coming from the universe.
Excuse me?
Sounds coming from the universe. Has there been any information regarding any kind of signals coming from the universe, intelligent at all? Intelligent signaling?
Not that I'm aware of, no. There's a group of scientists called the SETI group. That stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And for 30-odd years, they have been listening for radio signals that might come from some other planet around some other star. And they've become ever more sophisticated. They've had ever more powerful radio telescopes. And Paul Allen has funded a big new one in California. But so far, there has been no signal has been received. They can search very, very rapidly, a very, very wide band of frequencies, very rapidly, but no signal so far.
What about, I read in your book, it's the work that Hewish and his colleagues did when they detected pulse radio signals. What were those signals? Or do they know?
The pulsars?
The Hewish and his colleagues.
Oh, yes, we know what they are. Yes. they discovered, in the early 1960s, they had a radio telescope running in Cambridge, England, and they found they were getting repeating pulses of a certain radio frequency. And they thought, well, that's obviously due to automobiles or some other source of noise. But then the student, Jocelyn Bell, who's running the telescope at that time, found that the signals returned a few weeks later, and they were in a different position at the sky, a different position with respect to the telescopes, but the same position with respect to the stars. Then they knew they had an astronomical signal coming to them. And they thought at one time that it might be due to these kind of signals that the SETI people are listening for. That might be extraterrestrial signals. But then they found that there are other stars, there are other sources like that with different frequencies. They found a very, very wide band of frequencies. They realized it was a natural object. It must be some kind of star. And what it turned out to be are what are called neutron stars. Now, a star like the sun, as it gets older, it can burn up its fuel, then it can begin to collapse. And one possible end result is it forms what's called a white dwarf, which has the size of a few thousand kilometers, the size of a star. But another one is that it collapses even further until it has the same density as the nucleus of an atom, and that's then called a neutron star. All the neutrons and protons are bumping up against each other. Now, these objects are only a few miles across, and they can spin very rapidly. They can have very strong magnetic fields, and as they spin, they can give off these radio signals.
Okay.
You get a pulse every time that the beam swings by you.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Not that I would know, but it makes sense to me.
Good.
Now I want to ask you a couple of things, just because your focus is in astrophysics, right?
Yes.
So I want to ask you, do you have any idea about, or any, do you think about parallel universes and multiple dimensions?
I don't, but there are a lot of scientists who do. They talk about now, we have the idea of multiverses, that there are many universes like ours, where the physics is a little bit different from ours, and ours is the one where the physics is just right for life to develop. In the others, it may not be as congenial, and you may not have life in the others. But so the idea is that we're just one of many, many universes, but there's no way to contact the other universes. So it's just an idea that can't possibly be checked. So my point of view is not very good science from that point of view.
What is the difference between parallel universes and dimensions?
Well, I think that, well, put it this way. Imagine you have two sheets of paper, and one is an inch above the other, and each sheet of paper represents a universe with its own dimensions. Now, there's something separating the two, and so there's some unknown dimension that separates those two pieces of paper. If you're in that piece of paper and only move in it, you wouldn't know there's the other dimension, and you wouldn't know there's the other universe around. But in theory, that's possible.
So the dimension would be that the boundary of those things, and the universe would be those things within the boundary?
Well, the universe, there'd be two universes, each represented by a sheet of paper.
Right, okay.
And then there's the extra dimension, which is the separation between those two sheets of paper.
Oh, okay, I got it. Okay. I think about those things a lot. And would it be logical to you for there have to be an odd number rather than an equal number? If there were equal number of universes, wouldn't they collapse upon themselves?
Well, we have no idea. You know, we have no valid theory for this. I mean, the idea of multiverses is just an idea people are beginning to think about. So there's no theory that tells us how many. Some people think there could be zillions of them, and who knows? It's just an idea right now.
Yeah, I think about that stuff all the time. I don't know. I just do. Okay. What are you working on right now?
Fascinating. I'm glad you asked. You know that elements like radium decay. They give off electrons in the process. And if you look in textbooks, you'll find that each element has a certain decay rate. Nothing will change that decay rate. You can heat it and hit it with a hammer, it won't change. It turns out that's not correct. I am collaborating with some physicists at Purdue University, Dr. Ephraim Fischbach and his colleagues, and they noticed that the decay rates measured in two different laboratories show annual variations. They're not constant. It's a very small variation, about a fraction of a percent, but very, very significant. And so they had the idea that the sun might be influencing the decay rates. And I've been collaborating with them for the last 2 years and following up that question, and I'm finding very strong evidence that the sun is in fact responsible for these variations in decay rates. We do not now know what the mechanism is. We can speculate about it, but we really don't know. But we do know that these decay rates do vary, and there is strong evidence that the sun is responsible.
Now, tell me again what's decaying. I missed that.
Well, one would be silicon or chlorine.
Oh, okay.
To other elements.
Okay, elements.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean to us? What does that mean to somebody like me that has no idea?
I wish I could give a simple answer to that, because we're just beginning this, and we really don't know what it means yet. Well, what significance it'll be? It may turn out to be, we may find that it leads to knowledge of new particles that have new properties. And after all, when Faraday discovered electromagnetism, they had no idea it's going to lead to so many, to radio and TV and to computers and all that. It was, you know, very. People asked him, Mr. Faraday, what's the use of this? And they said, well, what's the use of a newborn baby, madam? We might be in the same boat. We have a newborn baby, and we have no idea what it'll be like once it grows up.
Now, how do you measure these things decaying? And what do you think the sun's doing? Is it something that has changed over a period of time, or did it? Was it always this way? Was the decay rate always like this, or did it change in the, well, some period of time?
How do you measure it? You have counters that count, say, electrons being produced or X-rays being produced, and you simply count how many decays are going on per second by measuring the count rate on this counter.
Oh, okay.
Now, what's happening in the sun, it must be that there is some field or some particle or some stream of particles being produced. For instance, it could be neutrinos. Neutrinos are strange particles that hardly interact with anything. They're produced during nuclear reactions, and of course nuclear reactions go on in the very center of the sun. That's how its energy is produced. And so there's a tremendous flux of neutrinos flying out from the sun through the Earth, through everything. And right now, there are 100 billion neutrinos a second going through your thumbnail, but you'd never know it.
Okay. You got to help me understand, because I understand what you're doing, what you've told me, but I'm not grasping. What made you start studying? And we've got, let's see, it's 8:43, and we got to stop at 8:55, so we don't have a lot of time. But what made you, why is this of interest? I mean, did something change about their decay rate that made you start doing this?
Well, what happened is I go to Scottsdale, Arizona on Thanksgiving every year, and in 2008, I was down in Scottsdale. When I'm there, I drive down to Tucson to visit the National Solar Observatory. And when I was there, one of the scientists, old Mark Giampapa, said, "Hey, there are some papers I've just seen that may interest you." And he showed me two papers by the Purdue scientists concerning the variation of these decay rates. And there were suggestions of a connection with solar flares. There were two events when flares occurred on the sun, and there appeared to be corresponding changes in the decay rates of these elements.
Oh, okay. I got to know.
That got my attention.
Okay. Well, it kind of seems logical to me, if things got hotter like that, that it would decay faster.
Yeah.
Okay.
But one of the things that interests me most in the work of SSE, the society, is completely different. It's the work of Bill Bengston.
I know him. Well, he was on here not too long ago.
Yes, I think his work is absolutely amazing. The way he's able to cure mice of cancer without even touching them. And the effect is so strong, they might be working with six mice, and either all of them go into remission, or five of the six go into remission. It's amazing.
Do you have, and remember, we don't have a lot of time. We got, because I want to ask you another couple questions too. Do you have any idea what is doing that from a physics perspective?
Well, physics, I think, is completely unknown. There's no way, on basis of known physics, how that can happen. But obviously, it involves consciousness. And so, to me, it means that we do not understand what consciousness is. We don't understand its effects on the human body or on other living things like mice. And so it's a tremendous challenge to understand what consciousness is.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was my next question. I ask every scientist that comes on my show, what is your definition of consciousness? Because that's one of the things that made me start my radio show.
Uh-huh.
Because I realize every single person that I ask, scientists, when I ask them that question, if I ask 30 people, yeah, I get 30 different answers.
Yeah.
And, you know, how are we ever going to make a model of physical reality? And that one of the reasons that I found is because people have different definitions, and so they're not on the same page about what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So that, you know, nobody can ever make a model if they can't communicate. about what they're talking, and they don't even know that they're not on the same page. That's a problem with that word, defining that word.
Yeah, I think most scientists would take the position that consciousness is just a manifestation of brain activity. We have a brain, it's a living object, and it has certain properties, certain way of operating, and the way it operates leads to what we call consciousness. Now, the trouble is that there are things that just don't fit with that interpretation, and that one of the most dramatic is that reincarnation, I'm very impressed by the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson, who passed away about 3 or 4 years ago, studying evidence for reincarnation. And it's amazing. If you come in with an open mind, you'll be very impressed with his research. If you come in with a closed mind, saying, no, consciousness is just brain activity, then you'll just find excuses not to take his work.
Uh-oh, you went off the air for a second.
Okay.
Not to take his work seriously, is that what you said?
That's right, yeah.
Well, that's kind of where when I went off on parallel dimensions and multiple universes, that's kind of what I was going to ask you about, was Ian's work. And do you think that, and most my listeners would be familiar with his work, generally speaking, I think. Do you think that there's a past and a future? Do you think it's really past and future, or do you think that it's all happening right now in just different spaces and space and time?
Well, that's a really tough question. I think that research in parapsychology is trying to address that question. I think we began with the idea that if you're trying to influence the output of a counter, using Helmut Schmidt's original experiments, that the operator, the person trying to influence it, somehow has a field or radiation of some kind that influences what's happening in the electronic counter. But now we find that the count rates are being influenced by what you're going to do in the future, not by what you're doing right now or have done in the past. So things are getting very, very complicated, and I think we just don't have the right vocabulary. We don't have the right concepts to begin to understand what's going on.
Interesting. I think that's kind of the general consensus that everybody says, too. I think it's interesting. Okay. Is there anything that you would like to talk about before we have to wind up in a few minutes? We've got about 6 minutes.
Well, I think the big puzzle to me is why scientists are not more curious. There are so many interesting topics which I think are fascinating, that are very challenging, that could lead to completely new knowledge, but most scientists are very reluctant to even look at them. And I don't know why that is, but I see a parallel, oddly enough, with the Shakespeare situation, which interests me, that there's strong evidence that the work we attribute to Shakespeare was not written by the guy from Stratford, but by somebody else. But there's strong resistance by the scholarly community or the English professors. There's very strong resistance to even consider that possibility. There's a parallel there.
Well, I think to me, it's so obvious it's ego. Somebody has to admit they're wrong.
Well, I wouldn't want to say that, but you could be right.
The truth. I mean, I get into this discussions all the time with my daughter's high school teachers. They're still teaching the old science that mass is everything there is.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea, because nobody that... the conventional science will not put the truth out there, because they have to say, you know what, maybe I was wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they were wrong, just maybe that they're incomplete, but nobody's willing to do that.
Yes.
Except a few people like you and Tiller and Radin and John and Don and Amit Goswami, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anything else?
No, I think it about wraps it up from my end.
Okay, there was something I wanted to ask you. see if I can remember what it was. It was one of those things where I kept wanting to spit it out, but I couldn't.
Yeah, well, the one thing that you could we could touch on is how can people learn about the research that's being done on these topics that are not in the mainstream? And I think the best thing is to go to the Society website, scientificexploration.org, and there you'll find a lot about the Society. You'll find all the issues of our journal, about 24 volumes of our journal, are right there on the website and available, just to click on.
You know, I did that for the first time today, and I didn't realize that everything was available online.
It really is.
I didn't know that. I thought you would have to pay for it. That was an excellent resource. Thank you.
No, I think the last, it could be that the last few issues are not yet posted, but everything up to a year ago is now online.
So what is your plans for the future to work on?
Well, I'm fascinated with the what I'm doing right now. I think the work on these decay variations is fascinating, and I think potentially quite important. It'll tell us something new about the sun and something new about particle physics. And I'm also very interested in a Tunguska explosion. I'm very interested in the Shakespeare authorship question. So I have many irons in the fire.
Okay, let's quickly, we got 2 minutes left. We never did fully address what your definition of consciousness is. Got off of that somehow.
No, we didn't, and I don't know what it is. I simply know what it is not. It's some reality, it's something that you can identify with a person or with an animal, which appears to be able to survive bodily death or be separate from the body.
Would you say it to be the irreducible unit? Would you know? Would that make sense to you?
Well, you know, there used to be an old-fashioned word called soul, and it's not politically correct to use that term anymore. It used to be that when a ship went down, you'd say it lost 100 souls or 200 souls. And we've lost that. So the concept is a living object, a human being, maybe animals too, have some reality other than the physical reality. And what it is, we don't know. But it's related to what we call consciousness.
Thank you, Dr. Sturck, for coming on my show.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure to have you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.